Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, and this is the second annual Floydcast. This is Floydcast 0002, and firing it off to you, February 24, is when I'm creating it. Anyway, last time I took a day to upload it because I edited it a little bit, getting rid of, you know, coughs and sputters and pauses and stammers and dogs being too loud in the background. Yes, this is the dog cast again, or the microwave cast. Hopefully, I'm trying to bring a bit of variety, but, you know, the nature of this is for me to sound off on things that are happening that are concerning or that are really cool and interesting or that I think you know, just something of the moment that you might be interested in. So I thought I'd start off with the Olympics. The Olympics wrapped up last night, Sunday night. I don't know. Can you watch closing ceremonies or opening ceremonies? I think the only way I've ever got through those in the last 20 years is recording it and then just fast-forwarding through the whole thing. I mean, okay, there can be some cool stuff, like in China. Pretty amazing what they did. As someone said, you know, China set the bar for opening ceremonies that no one's ever going to come near ever again. And that was amazing. But at the same time, you know, thousands of guys who have to spend the night in a box so that the next day when you wander into the stadium, they're like, oh, surprise, I'm in a box. That's going a little far. And just last night, I just caught a bit of it where, you know, guys are hanging from wires again, and you know, how many times can you do that? Okay, guys are hanging from wires, and you got lights shining on you. And what can you do on a wire? Wave your arms and legs. Can't talk. They probably don't have microphones. And probably grunting and groaning. I can't imagine being that comfortable to be in a harness and be suspended on a wire. And all that has to happen is one little thing to go wrong. And it's like, okay, we lost that guy. Any road. And the opening ceremony, I don't know about the class. I think they're both the same. That to me, the fundamental problem is 80% of it is people walking in or walking out. I mean, come on. Actually, I think it's sort of a mass entrance, isn't it, on the closing? They all just come in. They don't have to do it by country. I could be wrong there. It seems, from memory, that's how it goes. Anyway, miraculously, you know, they put on 4 hours of primetime TV for that, and people watch it. It's kind of amazing. But these games were interesting for several other reasons. I mean, one of them was that, you know, depending on your perspective, either the corruption, the $50 billion games was noteworthy, or the, you know, the two toilets joined together with no divider between them and no manhole covers and whatnot. You know, people wanted to criticize them for being not ready or wanted to criticize the corruption levels. Here's my thought on that. Okay, it's obvious that the games are corrupt. In fact, when you look at the documentary, The Passionate Eye in Canada had a good documentary on it, which you can get on YouTube. 80 minutes long or 75 minutes long, a big documentary. Basically, corruption in Russia is just simply the cost of doing business. And at times they even discuss the percentages. You get a third, I get a third, and a third goes to the project. So, if you take $50 billion and divide by 3, now you're getting the actual money that was put into the Olympics, $15 billion. And then $35 billion went into the pockets of people that are already rich and corrupt. Rich gangsters or rich politicians or whatever. So, you know, we can point at that and go, oh, aren't they terrible and corrupt? Well, here's the question. Do we really think it's any different in any other country? Do we really think that? Let's just take the money put into stadiums. Stadiums in general. Look at baseball in America and their stadiums and football stadiums. These stadiums go for like $1 billion a pop these days. But what happens is they go to cities and probably states and say, hey, look, we'll put our new stadium here if... And then they get all kinds of favors from it. And probably the reality is that $1 billion stadium almost doesn't cost them anything. And they probably make it back in whatever they put in a couple of years because it's, you know, it holds more people, they have more ways of making money from you, they jack up the price of concessions and, you know, charge you for who knows what, and the t-shirt, you know, costs twice as much. And it's a joke. You know, really, it's a joke that if you don't like sports, well, you're subsidizing sports. So whether it's the Olympics or baseball or football, you better like sports because you're paying for them. So, corruption at Russia. Okay, well, let's compare it to other Olympics. They were like, I guess the previous three Olympics cost around $2 billion each. So 2 plus 2 plus 2 is 6. My rough estimate of the actual money put into the actual games was 15. So even by that little calculation, these games are 2.5 times more than the last three put together. Hang on. All right, just letting the cat out. So you can certainly say that the games cost too much in Russia. For sure the games cost more, way, way more. But where were they held? They were held in a very warm climate. Now you can also point at that and go, well, that's corruption too. Yes, it is. They were held in a place that is not meant to hold Winter Olympics at all. It's the opposite. It's the warmest place in Russia. But at the same time, they pulled it off, and it's kind of a miracle. The Russian games are kind of a miracle. They had no infrastructure. They had one road, apparently one main road, and they needed, you know, to widen that and all these sort of things. You know, what they did is amazing. And they had something like 400 machines for making snow. 400. And, you know, when those machines were first made, a given mountain might have, what, a few? I remember seeing a few when I went skiing, like, let's say, half a dozen. 400? That's how you make snow when it's 40 degrees. It got as warm as 60. I heard temperatures of 60 Fahrenheit. Freezing is 32. So these are just not your regular games. There's no doubt about it. Just not your regular games. You have to accept that. But how about the coverage? Coverage was phenomenal. The quality of the images, top notch. They used little drones, apparently, at one point, that they could fly above the course for, like, I imagine, the cross-country. And it's probably mainly the biathlon and cross-country. Downhill, I guess. What they did with that snow was a miracle. Speaking of downhill, the downhill skiing, that course was, what, the longest, the highest, fastest? It set just about every record. And it was seriously exciting to watch. I had, what, four jumps or five jumps? One jump, they're, you know, seemed like they're going a football field in the air. Or it might have been half a football field, but it seemed like a full one. Put it this way, in the downhill course, going 80 miles an hour, you know, wide open, throttled, so to speak, they were going as fast and jumping as far as the guys jumping off the ski jump, where that's all they do. They have a track, they have special skis, that's all they're doing. And these downhillers were doing that as part of a 3-minute kamikaze run. I mean, so downhill, I enjoyed that. Cross country, I enjoy in biathlon because it's that cardiovascular, pushing yourself cardiovascular wise, and just who's got the heart. Last night, well, yesterday, Sunday, they showed the 50K men's cross-country. And the women's was just as remarkable, the 30K women's, the final one. And it's just pure. It's just pure cross-country and just a horrific distance. Took them almost 2 hours last night. Imagine going as basically as fast as hard as you can on skis for 2 hours. Their average speed was 15 miles an hour. When I ride my bike, my average speed, are you ready? I'm really slow. It's 10 miles an hour. So these guys are 50% faster than me on skis than I am on a bike, non-stop for 2 hours. Off the charts, man, off the charts. Really fantastic. And Russia 1-2-3, I thought that was great. And, you know, good karma, good luck for them. And they also won the four-man bobsled yesterday, and, you know, in fine fashion. And they should, right? They build the track. They get to practice 6 million times on the track, I imagine. Whoever builds the bobsled track should always win, whichever country that is. You know, should be. They should have four medals, and the people who build it, they get their own medal, but they're not allowed to compete. This year, in this Olympics, Winter Olympics, I just had no interest in figure skating. None at all. I mean, I grew up loving ice skating. From the earliest ages, I was ice skating and playing all sports, but, you know, in Canada, doing ice skating and watching hockey and that, you know, you just grow up with that. But this year, I just had no interest at all. Just, in fact, I ended up watching the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan documentary on ESPN, a little bit of the one on NBC last night. And probably ended up watching as much figure skating through that documentary this year as I did at the Olympics. It's just, again, you know, too much of a formula and not enough athleticism. Same with going down a half pipe or some of these, you know, events. I just don't consider them very athletic. They don't last very long. Your performance is measured in seconds. You know, some of these things, like short track speed skating, it's like 30 seconds for your 500 meters, whatever it is. You know, give me the 5,000 meters speed skating over the short track one. You give me the long one where they, and you look at the muscles on the legs of those speed skaters. Their one thigh is as big around as the trunk of my body. They're beautiful. They have beautiful thighs. I get excited about thighs when I watch speed skating. So I don't know. I think corruption-wise, okay, that's the way they do it in Russia. And frankly, who cares? What they've done is they've increased infrastructure, right? They've taken a resort area. Sochi is a resort area. It's interesting. No game was actually held in Sochi. No event. Sochi is an area. There's a town associated, and then there's an area. And so the games were all like, everything happened elsewhere, which is kind of funny. And by the way, it wasn't different in Vancouver. There might have been the odd event in Vancouver proper, but all the snow events were a long way away, so far away, they had to build a mountain over the top of the mountain. They had to build a highway over the top of the mountains going towards Whistler, and that, which is like 80 miles away or 60 miles away, whatever it is. So, you know, don't be too self-righteous about it. So the point is, they had to build their infrastructure. They had to improve roads. They had to build buildings. And those buildings, by the way, in Russia, they were nice. In China, they had the bird's nest or something. And it looked odd, right? But in Russia, they looked beautiful. There was one point where one of the buildings, I think it was during the hockey game, so where they play the hockey games, and it's a nice smooth, the outside of the building is very smooth. And it was like on an intermission. It was like 1-0. And they go outside, and just as they're going to commercial, they just show, a camera shows the outside of this building with the score in the roof of the building. And it just looked beautiful. It wasn't being like overly featured or overly, you know, presented. It was, there it was. It was integrated into the building. And so instead of an oddball bird's nest, you had a beautiful building with the score integrated. So to me, I take my hat off to Russia for integrating technology and art and we can get it done mentality into the games. They had to push themselves as a country, and they did it. And so I ended up enjoying the Olympics, and I'm going to have, you know, some good long-term memories for a couple of reasons, admittedly. In Canada the last time, 4 years ago, the Canadian men and the Canadian women won the gold medals, and the U.S., you know, sort of also-rans. Well, it happened again this time, and the Canadian men and women won the golds, and the U.S. were also-rans. And, of course, that's the way it should be. The U.S. has a lot of different sports, and it's a warmer country, right? It's a more southerly country. In Canada, you have hockey, you have ice skating, you have throwing snowballs at trucks that are trying to clear off snow from the roads, you have hockey night in Canada, and you have ice skates, and you have street hockey, and then you have the other sports. You know, it's big. It's big. Football is, you know, appreciated, but at the same time, there's, what, a couple of CFL teams. There's like 8 or 9, two of which have the same name, Rough Riders. That's kind of hilarious. You could have the Rough Riders playing the Rough Riders only in Canada. You know, Canadians are known for diplomacy, getting along. Maybe not diplomacy, for being nice. Canadians are known for being nice. And, in Canada, you can have two teams with the same name playing each other. Go Rough Riders. Who are you cheering for? The Rough Riders. Yeah, okay. So football is, you know, somewhat big, but there's only two or three big teams, and there's a few sort of kind of like the Green Bay Packers, small town, but a big team in a small town, if you will. There's a few of those teams. And then that's about it. You sort of run out of teams. You know, the NFL is packed full of teams. They want more teams. They're going throughout the world and the number one sport. But in Canada, you know, football is just, well, it just plays second fiddle to hockey. There's just no two ways about it. Maybe if there was no hockey in Canada, football would be a lot bigger. And college or university football in Canada is non-existent. It's there, and you get 1,000 locals, you know, 1,000 people from that university watching the game, and it's nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's not televised, I don't think, or anything. Baseball, what, we have one or two teams. Toronto and Montreal, the biggest cities, have their own team. Even Vancouver doesn't have their own baseball team. Other sports just don't measure up. So it's no wonder that Canada does great in ice skating. And they not too shabby in figure skating, and not too shabby in, you know, board, snowboarding type sports. Downhill, crazy Canucks, you know, they became that phrase some years back. So don't take it too hard, America. Hockey night in California, Wayne Gretzky standing at the sunset outside, standing out in front of the LA arena with his hockey stick, and behind you can see like a beach. It's a cultural thing. You just don't have the same number of facilities. People just don't grow up with ice skates and skating all the time. I've skated in Canada on frozen lakes in winter, and let me tell you, that is really awesome. It's really cold. It's too cold. You know, that's the civilized part of putting liquid ammonia underneath your ice surface, is that you can have a cold under there, but the building can be somewhat warmer. When you're outside in a frozen lake, it's frozen because it's really cold outside. And then you're skating along at 25 miles an hour, and now you have a 25 mile an hour wind chill factor. So skating outside is cold, but really unforgettable and pretty cool. So it's cultural. So I think the U.S., you know, the medals, and how did the U.S. do? I think they did fine. I think they got some issues in speed skating. I don't know what happened there. They didn't do very well. You know, the expectations were not met. But I think for the most part in other sports, they were. In the cross country, there was an American in second place for 40 kilometers of the race. So like for 25 miles of the race, this guy was number two. And like within a second, the whole time. That's an amazing achievement, to be the number two skier for 25 miles. It doesn't matter how you finished up, you know, because the Russians just sort of, you know, the wave of, you know, imagine performing in your home country, you're going to do well. You know, they just left the field in their dust, but very respectable how he did in that skiing. All right, so I thought that talking about the Olympics would be about 3 minutes, and we're 19 minutes in. So as I was leading up to this Floyd cast, I was thinking, gee, I've got a lot of things that have happened that I consider, you know, bad news. And I thought, well, I'll try and alternate the good news and the bad news, and then that way I won't, you know, drive you crazy. And I can still, you know, talk about the things that I think are important. You know, the Olympics, let's be honest, they're not important. Not one single solitary bit of it is. It's nice to see people performing and excelling. But at the same time, half the time, you know, like 2/3 of Americans are overweight or obese. They're not going to be in the Olympics, to say the least. So, I read a story yesterday, getting to the, let's call it the crazy news. This isn't the bad news, because it's not going to happen, but it's the crazy news. This is from the spaceindustrynews.com. A Japanese company proposes to build solar power cells on the moon to provide clean energy to Earth. So how did they get that power to the Earth? Microwave transmission. That's like Wi-Fi. That's like your cell phone. That's like a giant baby monitor sending energy to the Earth. Can you believe that? Can you imagine the effect of transmitting power? Now notice, we're not just trying to transmit a signal from the moon to the Earth. We're trying to transmit power. What we may not realize is, you know, cell phones are very low power. I mean, think about it. You can use a cell phone for days on that tiny little battery in there, because it's very miserly with its use of energy. Well, in this case, I'm even looking at the picture here. You should check this story out. SpaceIndustryNews.com. The drawing showing the power and, you know, the moon and the strip. I mean, talking about a strip, someone calculated like a 200-mile wide strip on the entire moon with, you know, solar cells. Sorry if I'm talking into the mic, let me move it. Anyway, the labeling of this ridiculous diagram, it's got like a little arrow for the moon, you know, going in a circle on top of the moon, and it says axial rotation of the moon. Yeah, the moon rotates, good for you. Ironically, the moon rotates once per month. It's actually tidally locked to the Earth, so it hardly rotates at all. In other words, from our perspective, it doesn't rotate at all. That's why we can't see the dark side of the moon, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, they got all these crazy things on this drawing, and then at the bottom of the drawing, it says master plan. Well, boy, did they get that right. The master plan of microwaves. Anyway, okay, so that's like the ridiculous bad news of the day. People were, you know, discussing this on various sites about, you know, what do you gain from picking up radiation from the sun, energy from the sun on the moon versus the Earth? Well, because there's no atmosphere, apparently you get 40% more energy. You know, if you got a kilowatt hour of energy on the Earth, you'd get, let's say, 1.5 on the moon. And then you're supposed to take the 1.5 on the moon and transmit it to the Earth. Well, the Earth does rotate. The Earth does rotate relative to the moon. So, of course, on this drawing, they show multiple places where they're going to transmit the energy because the Earth is rotating. So are you going to store it on the moon? Are you going to just waste it? If you're not able to transmit it at that moment, you need, you know, receiving sites all over the Earth. It has to go through the Earth's atmosphere. So you've got this 40% more energy in the moon, and now you're going to transmit it through the atmosphere of the Earth. You have to get all the equipment to the moon. You have to build this enormous, enormous structure. It's just so ludicrous. And then the capper, microwave radiation. They're going to transmit microwave radiation to the Earth. I'm almost at a loss for words. If you were talking, you know, nuclear, this would be like saying we're going to blow up nuclear bombs on the moon, and when the bomb blows up, you get all this hot air, and we're going to trap that hot air, and we're going to send it back to the Earth. It's about that well thought out. So speaking of bangs, see that transition? Now that's one of those smooth transitions. That's why you listen to this Floydcast, for those smooth transitions. Speaking of bangs, I read a story, and the title of it says, Big Bang Secrets Swirling in a Fluid Universe. The part that I sort of clipped out here, it says, a new model that treats the matter in the universe as a fluid could enable researchers to retrace the flow of the cosmos back to the Big Bang, blah, blah, blah. And they show a picture that's completely irrelevant, but anyway. So what's the news here? Treating the universe as a fluid. Well, here's what makes this news. Today in physics, like for the last uncomfortably long time since relativity, Einstein, in creating, in quotes, relativity, he took existing theories from Poincaré and Lorentz and Larmor, And he took out the ether component, and then he said, here's my theory. And he didn't give them credit. So that was all horrific. But he took out the ether being the medium. Well, now they're saying the universe is a fluid. Doesn't that sound like there's a medium involved? Yeah. So that's a major change in itself. Sean Carroll, a very credible guy. I like this guy. He came up with a great course. The series is called The Great Courses. He came up with a great course called Dark Matter, Dark Energy. That's where I first listened to him. You'll see him on TV and, you know, space-type programs. He'll get quoted. And he's a very reasonable guy. He has, like, just a well-moderated voice. He's not, like, too out there. But his physics, his fundamentals are super good. Anyway, he's backing this group. And he called them a plucky bunch. I wonder if I've got the quote somewhere. It'd be kind of awesome if I could just pull that out. Let's see if I can find it. All right, I fail on being organized, if I admit it. But I remember the phrasing that Sean Carroll himself said that they were a plucky bunch, and this was the way forward. Well, the reason I'm smiling while I'm talking is, this is spring and loop theory, sort of. Spring and loop theory says that every spot in the universe, including on Earth, you know, in between your fingers, inside your finger, everywhere, there's a medium, you can call it an ether, it's energy. And I call it spring-like, spring and loop theory, but it definitely has a fluid-like property. I say it's not a fluid, I say it's a gas, which is kind of like a fluid. But gases, you know, sort of implies higher energy. And the springs are the highest energy, and then matter are the loops, the stabilized loops, and the loops and the springs interact. Anyway, I was just kind of amazed when I saw this, because it's the first time I've seen anything since I came up with my theory. I thought of it 15 months ago, published it 13 months ago. This is the first time I've seen anything anywhere where something remotely resembling my theory is being put forward. And this is all early stages with these guys. I'll keep you posted. So that was one of my cool things of the day. Let's see here. What else did I want to go on? Okay, so that was like in the category of good news. See how I'm alternating? Olympics was good to me. Microwaves from the moon was bad, but ludicrous. And then the Big Bang, you know, fluid universe and how it's sort of supporting my theory, spring and loop theory. I came up a year later, I started to flesh it out more, and I started to realize some sort of deeper realizations, and so I call that consequences of a spring and loop theory. And I've been running the consequences series, and I'm up to 5 videos of that, so I like to plug my videos. If you go to YouTube, type in Floyd Maxwell, you'll probably bring up my videos, and you can go to my website and see them. The first one was on the speed of light. I predict the speed of light is slowing down. It has been and is. Talk about black holes, a little bit of revolutionary stuff there, not a lot. E equals MC squared and how E equals MC squared, famous equation, 3 variables. Those are the only variables, those are the only things going on in my theory. Energy, which is springs, mass, which is loops, and C, the speed of light, is how fast do these springs vibrate. So I haven't done the math, maybe it's easy, I just am not interested in doing the math on it, but I think it's sort of trivial probably to get E equals MC squared from my theory. Anyway. And then talk about the ether and the force of the series. And then most recently, I think yesterday, I published the one on gravity. And I'm kind of proud of the one on gravity because no one can explain what it is. They can sort of give you some, well, here's the effect. And then it turns out the effects aren't what we predict. And there's all these anomalies. I mean, all kinds of anomalies with gravity. And I think I finally figured out the gravity thing. And so I'm kind of proud of that series. It's been enjoyable to work on. And no one watches them. Well, maybe you watch them, but no one else does. So thanks for watching. Is it Bob? Okay, thanks, Bob. All right, moving along. Boy, I feel organized and in a rush all at the same time, he said, coughing into the microphone. And taking a big slurpy drink. See, what I'm hoping for in this series is to go off-grid, you know, to go off-road, and to be a little more spontaneous. So here's an effort at spontaneity. I just took a sip of Pete's coffee. This is P-E-E-T-S. And if you look into Pete's coffee and the history in coffee, it's really kind of cool because basically there was a point in the past where Starbucks started to happen. It turned out that could have been Pete's. And they kind of went, no, we want to make good coffee. We don't want to franchise. And it's sort of interesting what happened since then. Pete's is, you know, let's call it regional. It'd be like Fred Meyer's in the West, you know. I don't know. Have you heard of Fred Meyer's in the East of the U.S.? Have you heard of it in Britain? But Pete's is the real deal. I'm trying to think of an analogy, like, from another field. Like, I guess it would have to be high-end cars comes to mind. It'd be like some company making these super high-end cars, and they just don't really care how everybody else makes cars. And Mercedes comes to mind. They make super good cars. They're super robust, rugged cars, and yet some degree of luxury or certainly comfort. They last forever. They're safe. They're innovative. They're just so different than the rust buckets that other countries make. Anyway, so that's my diversion. That's my musical interlude. Now back to business. Okay, this is news. I'm going to skip one of my items here. Hang on. I'm skipping one of my bad news items because there's another bad news item that I want to talk about even more. The Fitbit. Right now that you'll see on TV, I've seen a lot of ads for Nike's Fuel, F-U-E-L, band, a band that you put in your arm. And it, who knows, tracks your calories or some stupid thing. Who knows? Why anyone who has a normal head on their shoulders would want any of this crap? I have no idea. But it looks cool. Maybe it's a way to show off your money. Anyway, the Nike Fuel comes to mind as a band you put on your arm. Then there's smartwatches, of course, put on your arm. And these things all communicate with microwaves. They call it Bluetooth. Isn't Bluetooth friendly? It's blue and it's a tooth. Oh, that sounds harmless. It's microwave radiation that's going from the device to either another device on your person, which then has to microwave it off to a third place, or it's, I don't know, but it's microwaves. You can't get around it. You're sticking microwaves on your body perpetually. Why people are doing this, it just shows the level of ignorance. Anyway, the Fitbit, F-I-T-B-I-T, is another one of these devices. Well, they were in the news this last week. Why? They're in the news because the device caused, in some number of people, in the dozens or hundred category, it caused rashes and burns. Okay, so rashes, allergy, right? Well, no wonder it caused allergies, because it's made out of surgical-grade stainless steel. Wait a minute, surgical-grade stainless steel, that's not the kind of thing that causes rashes. So what caused the rashes? And then, while you're contemplating that, what caused the burns? Well, it turns out that microwaves are perfectly capable of causing burns. You can burn food in a microwave, right? So they have not admitted it. No one in the media has pointed the finger. To me, it's obvious. The device was cranking out so many microwaves, it was burning people's flesh. Let me just say, that is so far beyond what's okay. When we're not talking like twice as much as it should have been putting out. Clearly, this is like the Toyotas that were crashing into things, the Priuses, you know, and they're still trying to figure that one out, what caused that. So, there you have, a Fitbit is fit for what? Well, it's fit for killing you, in my mind. It's putting out microwaves, which are going to prove to be the deadliest thing of the 21st century. It's causing rashes and burns on your arm. Seriously? Seriously? You can look it up for yourself. Please do. Research this subject. Very sobering. All right. Hang on. All right, I'm back from that low-tech break. Okay, the thing that I'm going to talk about more in the future, and I'm not going to have time this week, is smartphones and their radiation levels. When I did some, sort of my original testing, some phones had low radiation, and I even got one of these phones for someone I know, and then it turned out it had really, really high radiation, and I'll talk about that next time. Okay, so I wanted to close off with a good story. See how I started with the Olympics, something good, and I threw in something funny in the middle, which I've forgotten what it was. I think it was maybe not funny, but it was me talking about my consequences of a spring and loop theory series. I'm kind of proud of that. I did some other videos too, by the way, before I forget. I did the moving video. I wrote the article on moving almost 10 years ago, but recently I did the video for it. And I'm kind of proud of that video and the article now, because I took the article and I totally revamped it, and it's pretty organized. And as I did the recording for it and thought about it, I'm kind of pleased with the level of detail I put in there. Now, moving, you don't do it very often, but it's usually a fiasco, right? And so I'm kind of proud of that as a tip video. And, a fun video. It's got its moments. So you might want to check that out, too. I think it's pretty cool. Just as an aside, to mention the dogs. You know, the dogs are a lovely part of my life, and I enjoy them. But one of my dogs licks too much. I mean, licks his paws by the hour. he's getting older. I'm a little worried for him. You know, maybe it reflects he's either in pain or whatnot. Hopefully not. That's my little random dog story. Don't have too much to report on the dog front. Other than they move around, they have to tell them, hey, come on, I'm recording. Tone it down. All right, so finishing off with good news. I moved a tree within the last week. I forget the day. I think it was about a week ago. I moved a tree. I transplanted a tree. What actually has happened is I've effectively transplanted three trees in the last, 3 months. We have a couple spots in the front of the property where we can fit trees in. And we had a neighbor had given us an apple tree that didn't work out. We had it a long time. It didn't grow hardly at all. The apples were inedible, and it didn't have a fundamental trunk, like a straight trunk, so it looked like someone had stepped on it. So that one was sort of in our bad dog box. And we had another tree, a Japanese maple, beautiful tree, small, but getting there, hang on. So we had a Japanese maple that was in a nice spot. We have a corner lot, and it was on the corner. And we gave it a lot of room to grow, and it would have filled up that corner really quite nicely, but slow growing. Not all that healthy looking. I guess sort of the nature of those trees. They never take off. They're kind of a slow grower. Anyway, where we live, the wind sort of barrels down that road. And there's some super tall trees just near on our the edge of our property and then just before our property so that the wind gets funneled even more. And we get some really serious wind blowing through that particular area. And this poor little tree has really suffered. And so I thought, let's take this nice Japanese maple and let's put it into the spot where this apple tree was. And then our kids got a tree from a farmer's market almost 10 years ago, a spruce. And they got it like, you know, 1 foot long. Here, have a spruce and a cigar. And we planted it in various spots in the backyard and it never looked great. And then we got the dogs and then the tree was like, who knows what the dogs were doing to it. But the poor tree was like, hey, I can barely grow here. What are you trying to do to me? So we put it into our side yard. And our side yard, with the way the fencing is designed and the fact that one of the fences stopped working and so we had to board it off, the side yard for a period of years there was not used, basically. It produced weeds, and I carefully harvested the weeds and put them in the recycling each year. We had a great relationship, the side yard and I. I left it alone, and it produced weeds. So we put the spruce in there. And I would periodically, once a year or so, twice a year, I'd weed around the spruce so that it could see the light. Well, this area was really sheltered. And this spruce is now 8 feet tall. And straight as an arrow. Going straight up, it's like, hey, I got to go to the light. Because, I mean, there's so many factors in that side yard. It's got to grow vertically. So this tree is doing pretty good. But in the side yard, it was right next to a fence. And this is a tree that's, you know, could eventually be, you know, 2 feet across, and it's at the 2-inch across stage, but it's right next to a fence, so that's already a problem. And then the distance to the houses on both sides is, you know, 6-8 feet, so that's a problem. And so it needed to be moved, and so it became the tree that was going to go into the corner, the prime corner spot where the Japanese maple was. So I dug out the apple tree, half an hour job, gave it back to the neighbor. Great, everybody happy. Now I got to move that same day I figure, well, I'll move the Japanese maple over, right? Just take it up, move it over. The Japanese maple's about 4 or 5 feet high. And you figure, it's a Charlie Brown tree. It has no roots. You know, trivial task, right? One of the things our neighbor told us about the Japanese maple is that he said our tree was quite valuable. And he said, they're really worth a lot. And, you know, your tree could be worth $500. And I was like, you got to be kidding. Why? Well, now I know why. Roots. This Japanese maple, when you start digging it up, is nothing but roots. And you want to talk root ball? You look in the dictionary under root ball, you'll see Japanese maple. I guarantee it. You go and look right now. I'll wait. This thing was just took forever. The roots went down. The roots went across. There was nothing but roots. And then the root ball, once you've dunked this thing up, you know, start to actually be able to move the thing. Now try and transport it. Because the thing weighed hundreds of pounds. Oh, man. It took 4 people at one point to get this thing out of... just out of the spot where I'd planted it. And I was able to move it, I think, myself by rolling the tree on its root ball. And we plopped it in, and it's been doing great in the new location and all that. But that was a humbling thing. Now I'm worried about this tree in the side yard, and I'm like, I need equipment. This tree is way bigger. The spruce in the side yard is like 8 feet tall. And it's going to be a monster. And I'm looking online and how big a root ball you need, and it's going to be 400-pound root ball, and how are we going to do it? So I ordered all the equipment, and it took a while to arrive. And anyway, it arrived like a couple weeks ago. So last week came time. The other thing is you want to do it in the middle of winter. You want to do it while it's, you know, cold, while the tree is somewhat dormant, because it's a spruce, it's an evergreen, and it's growing all the time. And, of course, we had this hole, this massive hole in our prime spot in our front of our property. As one of the neighbors said, you know, what are you going to do with that hole? You know, so the neighbors are drumming their fingers, watching their property values go down. And we're like, yeah, we're getting to it. Hang on. So last week, started digging the spruce. And I'm figuring, boy, this could be the job of my life trying to do this, you know. And we had like a fence within a fence situation. I had added yet another fence in there. So this thing actually had fences on two sides. So I had to undo all that, and then that meant the dogs could, you know, currently they could get into the side yard, and I had to board things off so they couldn't get in the side yard while I was working on it. I was like, oh man, this is a full-scale project. I start digging up this spruce. The ground is perfect. It had rained a fair bit, and I guess there hadn't been a lot of foot traffic in that side yard for years, and we had put, you know, we'd throw our leaves in there from all of our trees in there, and so you had a nice bed of leaves, which who knows, maybe that was good for the soil. Whatever it was, this was some of the easiest digging I've ever done, which, by the way, I estimate I ended up digging about 5,000 pounds of soil just to move this spruce. So I'm going down almost 4 feet down. I never did find the bottom of the roots, 4 feet down, and it has roots on all sides. But the interesting thing was that it didn't have a root ball in the usual sense. And in fact, the soil was sort of unique, almost like sandy soil. It would just come off of it. It ended up, the spruce tree was the Charlie Brown tree. The roots, which were very long, but they had almost no soil sticking to them. And I was able to carry the tree myself. So I did get it done in one day. We did move it. We stuck it in that corner. We splayed out the roots. There's a lot of roots. I really preserved the roots as much as I could. I'm really kind of pleased with how well I preserved the roots. Filled it in. And then that night, we had one of the worst storms of the winter. Windier than, choose your word, probably 40 mile an hour winds. And I went outside and I just acted as a windbreak for this tree. I just stood there with my hood on and just like, man, this is horrible. I hope this tree's going to survive. Are the branches going to be ripped right off? Because this tree had been in a sheltered side yard. I mean, really sheltered. And suddenly we were just throwing it out to the elements. I really felt bad about that. Well, miraculously, the next day, the tree was still somewhat vertical. It was slightly pushed over. I had put no support in because it had such good roots and so deep. I thought it doesn't need, you know, a post or metal post or whatever to support it. Well, I put one in the next morning, only aimed at counteracting the wind, nothing else. Anyway, this tree looks grand. We enjoy it pretty much every day. It's straight and tall. It looks green still. It doesn't look the worse for wear, despite being moved and that very traumatic storm that night. And, you know, what's the symbolism there? This is a world where people, you know, live in the moment, right? And it's getting worse, right? Our attention spans are shortening and shortening to the point, how many things have you done while you've been listening to this podcast? Okay, if you're driving, that's different. But if you're not driving, how many things have you done? You've been surfing, you've been eating, you've been drinking coffee, you've been checking your phone 3 times or 6 times or sending a text. You know, we're in that kind of a mentality these days. Well, what's the opposite of that? A tree, especially planting a tree. You know, you plant a tree, you're saying 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I want something nice. Even better, 30 years from now, I want to give something nice to other people when I'm no longer here. That's kind of cool. And that's what I did with that spruce tree. So think about it. You can plant a tree. They're not expensive. Maybe maybe you don't have property. Maybe your parents do. Plant a tree on their yard. Go to your neighbors and say, hey, do you want to plant a tree? In this area, we have a registered, you know, not-for-profit organization just to help people plant trees. Maybe you have something in your area. Sometimes people will take on, you know, a given piece of the earth, a given piece of property, a given spot, and they'll tree it. You know, they'll have like a work bee, and a whole bunch of people will go in and plant a whole bunch of trees. When I went to the University of British Columbia, one of the cool things was in the main walkway, I forgot what they call the darn thing, everything there, all the names are so religious and so creepy that I try and forget them as much as possible. The boulevard, the main boulevard, it was lined with oak trees. And, you know, graduating classes would plant an oak tree. Now, when you plant an oak tree, you're investing in a future. And you can say, well, you know, it's a little different there. And yeah, it is. These people were doing it because the guys before them did it. They feel obligated. Tree's not for them. But it is for others. It is for the future generations of students, and it's symbolic, right? When you get an education, it's good for the next 50 years. I got my degree in engineering. I have never worked in that field, but I'm really glad I got that degree. It's changed my thinking, and I'm kind of proud of it. I draw from that. I gain from that all the time. So when you plant a tree, it's the same story. You and your neighbors will draw from and gain from that tree, and you're investing in the future, and you're saying, the present moment isn't quite as important as they would have us believe. So I moved a tree, and it's kind of cool. All right, so I'm going to sign off, but just remember, truth is more important than freedom. Don't get distracted by freedom. Look for truth. Be a slave to truth. It'll set you free. So this is Floyd Maxwell doing his Floydcast for February 24, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.